Counsel.
Morning, Your Honors. My name is Don Barmeister. I'm here this morning representing Dolores Francis in this case, and we're here to discuss the decision by the trial court announced in its order that the reason my client's products liability claims were dismissed or could not be allowed to go forward in Bethel was required by the logic of the Food and Drug Administration holding in Brown and Williamson, which held that the ban on tobacco products relating to the FDA's application would require the similar logic that ban would require plaintiffs' products liability cases in state courts to be banned. That is not the holding of Cipollone, which is the law. That case was discussed in the FDA Brown and Williamson case three times. At no point was that case reversed. Cipollone is still good law. Cipollone says state law claims for product liability can go forward.
But in this case, the district court judge didn't rely upon Cipollone, did it? It relied upon Brown versus Williamson, which relied on the collective premise of regulatory statutes intended to keep tobacco products on the market.
That's correct. The logic that the trial court relied on, Your Honor, is that the FDA holding is that the FDA itself may not regulate tobacco in any way, something that the FDA had confessed for several decades prior to that holding, but in 1996 made an attempt to assert that it could regulate. The FDA case is strong in that position. Clearly, FDA itself may not regulate. However, that is not a conflict preemption case relative to state law claims. And there is no discussion in the case that would suggest state law claims are differently handled than they were handled in Cipollone. Cipollone's a 92 case. The FDA case is a 2000 case. We have cases going forward on the theory of state law liability as recently as 2006 and 2008. There are significant cases. Both the Florida Appeals Court and the California Appeals Court has held products liability cases sometimes can go forward, and they're not preempted either by the narrow preemption of the original Federal Cigarette Labeling Act standard or any kind of implied preemption from the FDA case.
What do we make of the fact that the United U.S. Code proviso that they relied upon in the FDA decision, Section 1311, was repealed in 2004. They relied on the six pieces of legislation, and then they relied also, the court relied on the code provision, said the marketing of tobacco constitutes one of the greatest basic industries of the United States without ramifying activities which directly affect interstate and foreign commerce at every point, and stable conditions therein are necessary to the general welfare. They're quoting 7 U.S.C. 1311A. That was repealed in 2004. Do we give any significance to that?
Now, I don't know what the significance of that would be to this case.
I would think it would help your case.
It certainly may, Your Honor.
But you haven't focused on that.
I have not focused on it. I don't want to argue a position that I think is different from the basic standard we're suggesting here, which is that clearly you cannot find in the FDA case, which is the basic case upon which Philip Morris relies, any holding saying the state law claims ability to go forward under Cipollone has been changed.
No, I understand, but I think what they're saying is, I understand it, they're saying that the Supreme Court in FDA essentially went through an analytical process which says, if we look at what Congress has done for implied preemption, not express, but implied preemption, we take a look at all of these statutory provisos they've made, including, at that time, also the provisions that I just quoted, all of which indicate that Congress has made it clear that it will not accept any state regulation that would have the effect of banning tobacco products from the market. And a strict liability theory, state tort strict liability theory, would essentially wind up doing that, because it has nothing to do with negligence, not just strict liability, the manufacturer's strict liability. The consequence of that, which Cipollone itself recognized, Justice Stevens in the first part of the opinion said, damage actions can have enforcement consequences. But then Cipollone restricted, of course, it to advertising and labeling. But now you have FDA comes along and makes that statement of looking at, from an implied preemption standpoint, all of this panoply of legislation. So that's what I'm trying to understand, is whether we should infer from that an implied preemption of anything that would have the functional equivalent of what the FDA would have had to do, which is ban tobacco from the marketplace.
I think the answer to that, Your Honor, is that I may not be tracking exactly the court's intention in that particular area. This is a broad record before the court with many case issues and statute. But the claim by plaintiffs in this case does not match what Justice O'Connor said would have to follow in the FDA case, which is if the FDA regulated, would have to ban all cigarettes. The claim in this case is a claim similar to that in Arquise and Mullock for a products liability analysis based primarily on the twin part standards of Barker law, which is the law this state adopted from California, and that is a defect case and a design defect case. There are twin design defects here, just as there were in Arnett's, and as one of those defects was found in the Bullock case. Those defects are a failure in design that is tested by the risk-benefit analysis, as was sustained in the Bullock case, and a failure as in design, as was sustained in the Arnett's case, for three separate defects. Now, those defects had not been discovered in this case yet, because I had no chance to do discovery. But presumably, Marlboro cigarettes were at issue in these cases. That's the claim of the cases before this court. The defects that exist in those cases may well exist in this case. It's the same defendant. And we're not suggesting, through our complaint, that we would have the same preemptive effect, or rather the same elimination effect of all cigarette sales in the state of Alaska, because of the design defect problems with these cigarettes. The design defect problems identified in our NITS were additional changes used to make inhaling easier, additional changes which made nicotine easier to absorb, and additional changes that increased the carcinogenic effects of certain chemicals in the tobacco.
So these design defects are beyond the inherent addictive and cancer-causing cigarette characteristics of cigarettes. You're alleging design defects beyond that?
That's right, Your Honor. It's not simply what cigarettes, as all cigarettes have to have, but it's an enhanced cigarette standard because of these defects as identified in our NITS. Now, I have to confess to the court, I have not had any chance at discovery, so I can't bring that proof forward. But given the opportunity to discover, I will, I believe, bring that proof forward. And we have alleged in paragraph 21 of our complaint both elements of the twin Barker law, the design defect analysis, unsafe, defective, and risk greater than utility. It's the same two standards that you find in Arnett's and Bullock.
Okay.
Your Honor, I see I have a minute and a half left. Could I reserve a minute for rebuttal?
Sure can.
Questions on
you can reserve your whole time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure.
May it please the Court, John Phillips. The question is, and for this court, did the plaintiff allege a product defect claim that was valid under Alaska law? Now, you just heard at the conclusion of this argument about a product defect claim that was not alleged in the complaint. If you read the complaint, as I have many times, there are only two allegations. The opening brief recites them: unsafe and addictive. Those are inherent characteristics of cigarettes, not simply the unnamed cigarettes the plaintiff's decedent smoked here, but all cigarettes. So the entire focus of implied conflict preemption is when you have a sweeping product defect claim, such as the one here, where the only defect identified in the complaint is a defect which is an inherent characteristic of the product.
Isn't the test really not within the complaint, but what could be in the complaint?
No, it's not, Your Honor. You're right.
In other words, you don't think plaintiff deserves an opportunity to amend?
Well, certainly not in this context where we're talking about removal jurisdiction based on fraudulent joinder. If we were here before the court with a 12b6 motion, courts always indulge the possibility of giving a person leave to amend. But we weren't here for dismissal. We were here to find out whether or not the federal court had jurisdiction. And in that context, this court always evaluates removal on the basis of a complaint as filed at the time of removal. Otherwise, it becomes an entirely manipulative process. I could amend the complaint based on what the court said, and jurisdiction would not exist. That's not the standard for purpose.
Well, you're the one trying to create federal jurisdiction here, aren't you?
That's true, Your Honor.
So, but we don't readily, if anything, cuts the presumptions or against creating some circumstance that would create federal jurisdiction. You're trying to create for federal jurisdiction by knocking out what, under state law, could well be a legitimate defendant.
You're right.
And you're saying, and as I understand it, just so I want to make sure I understand your argument, you are saying that this court should say that a purported state liability, product liability case purports to sound in strict liability is implicitly preempted, implicitly, a second implicitly, by the FDA decision in Brown and Williamson, because there is no given Cipollone, or Cipollone, however it's pronounced, which is have been narrowly drafted by the written by the Supreme Court to limit to advertising and labeling. You're saying that the result in this case would be you can't bring a strict liability case in state courts based as the way it was alleged in this case, based on the FDA case, which had to do with agency jurisdiction.
I detect two questions in that, Your Honor. I want to address both of them. The first point, I think, just really relates to the related question that the judge was talking about, Judge Tsushima, relating to the pleading standards. Mm-hmm. And all I'm saying in that respect is what you heard about, I will have a chance to discover the defect at a later point in time, is not notice pleading standards in Alaska or anywhere else. Certainly not in light of Bell Atlantic versus Twombly by the United States Supreme Court.
But why does it, I'm trying to play off Judge Tsushima's question, too. You're saying if this were a 12b-6 case, then leave to amend would have been given. And yet the consequences of your argument is he doesn't get chance leave to amend to narrow his claim down. We are going to declare, as the Ninth Circuit, that a broadly pled, unamended complaint is preempted implicitly by the FDA decision.
Well, I want to get to the implicit preemption point, but before leaving that, Your Honor, what I am saying is that when a party pleads an overly broad product defect theory that identifies in the complaint as the defect, this is not a forgotten or an omitted defect. The defect is unsafe and addictive. That's what's pled. And then articulates only that argument throughout four rounds of briefing until an oral argument in the Ninth Circuit. Counsel says, I think I can find a real defect that would not be so sweeping if you allow me to take discovery. That does not meet those pleading standards, and one does not, as an appellate court, permit that for purposes of challenging the removal jurisdiction of the court.
What about, counsel, what about the allegations that there are efforts to mislead the public? Isn't that...
Well, if you look at their opening brief, Your Honor, and again, this is a waivable event. You can't just keep changing your argument before an appellate court. If you look at the opening brief, they identify design defects of being unsafe and defective. There is a count for a reckless failure to warn. You will not find it defended in the district court, and you will not find it defended in the opening brief on appeal. So if we had had a failure to warn claim, which was count three in the complaint, we would be having a different discussion than if counsel had not focused solely on product defect based on a design defect and tried to defend that throughout. You're right, there is a claim for failure to warn or, you know, recklessly concealing and so forth, but we put in evidence on that with respect to the Alaska Commercial Corporation. We put in arguments relating to that, related to the remand motion, and they were unresponded to, which is why the district court said, apparently, the plaintiff is limiting their argument against fraudulent joiner.
Can I bring you back just to one of your statements that you made? I'm looking at paragraph 21, and it says, not that they are unsafe and addictive, it says unsafe and defective.
That's right, Your Honor. When I said addictive, I was referring to paragraph 39.
Yes, so the first paragraph, we're in the products liability count, right?
That's right. But there's also an addiction claim on paragraph 39, and it says they're unsafe and defective. But what is the defect?
Well,
under pleading standards, you have to identify the defect.
Is that Alaska law?
Absolutely. And I'll cite you the case that you should look at in that regard, because this is the point that was made in the reply brief. The case is Valdez Fisheries, a 2002 case, 45 Pacific 3rd, 657, and I'll quote very briefly. Modern notions of notice pleading notwithstanding, a plaintiff is nonetheless required to set forth factual allegations respecting each material element necessary to sustain recovery. As to unpled theories, the court said the court need not conjure up unpled allegations or contrive elaborately arcane scripts to save a complaint for dismissal.
Now, if that's the case, I'm still coming back now to Judge Tashima's point, is if this were in state court and you were making that objection, would the state court throw them out for failing to plead with specificity, or would they be given leave to amend?
Your Honor, it could be thrown out or with leave to amend without prejudice. If I were a trial court, I would give them leave to amend.
Yes, and so now we're over on federal side.
That's
where
right.
You've removed it, and why should a federal district court not provide leave to amend to avoid having to then go on to a ruling, which we're being basically asked to make, off of an over-generalized complaint? Why should we launch into making new law and extending Brown and Williamson under those circumstances?
Well, let me turn to the new law point in a moment. But let me simply say this, Your Honor. There is a difference when one's evaluating whether or not a complaint is going to be dismissed on 12b-6 and leave to amend, and whether one is going to be evaluating the jurisdiction of the federal court. And in that context, this court repeatedly, as we have all other courts have said, confines their discussion to the question of what did the complaint say at the moment of removal. If you did, as you are suggesting, allow someone to say, well, you didn't do it right, will you amend and then I'll send it back to state court, you would be allowing and permitting plaintiffs or any other party trying to avoid federal court jurisdiction to manipulate the process.
Well, counsel, let me just tell you, speaking for myself, the idea of us crafting an opinion that says there's fraudulent joinder because Supreme Court law has implicitly now said that Congress implicitly has preempted state product liability claims that are grounded in the simple notion, as you're characterizing it, as unsafe and addictive, when the pleading talks about unsafe and defective. It seems to me that we're bending over backwards. I mean, you analogize to the constitutional avoidance jurisprudence. I don't really feel comfortable using this as the vehicle to create law that I'm sure you'd like to have, but I'm not sure I'm prepared to give it.
Let me make 2 points. My time is almost out. Now, in response to that, Your Honor. First, you are absolutely right that my argument is not based on all product defect claims being implicitly preempted by FDA versus Brown & Williamson. That's not the argument. I've even given you cases which show where someone actually cited to specific additives and so forth, where the defect, if it were fixed, would not result in the elimination of the sale of cigarettes. That's not an implied conflict preemption case. It's not this case. I rely upon the overbroad allegations of this plaintiff. So with respect to implied conflict preemption, it is this claim we're evaluating, not general. And then second, with respect to the question of Your Honor being uncomfortable with the notion of not being allowed to let a plaintiff to amend their complaint when they haven't done it correctly for purposes of removal of jurisdiction. I have the burden before the district court, but it's based on that complaint. And if you read the briefs that this plaintiff made throughout the district court for purposes of the district court's analysis of the question, they never mentioned any of these potential defects that we're talking about. And I ask you finally, because my time is up and I apologize, is it prudent for a court to permit a plaintiff to allege a defect and not know what it is? Because that's what you just heard. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm going to respond to the last question. This is a case that came out approximately 4 to 6 months before our complaint was filed. It's prudent to look at these reported cases and the new cases should go forward based on that evidence, but not have it in your hand. I think the answer has to be yes. We need discovery to show what has happened.
So, did you ask for leave to amend at any time?
We did not, Your Honor. We have pleaded a well-pled case under the notice pleading law of the state of Alaska. If you look at paragraph 21, it relates to both forms of marker flow, standard for notice pleading, or rather standard for product defect pleading. We have alleged unsafe, defective, and risk greater than utility. Both standards meet the consumer product safety, or rather the unreasonable risk to the consumer test. They also meet
Where have you alleged that?
We're looking at paragraph 21, Your Honor.
What is your response to Mr. Phillips's, the case he cited that even under Alaska's notice pleading rule, at least in some cases, you've got to allege some facts in order to give notice of what your claim is?
What is the defect?
There's no notice of what the defect is there?
There is, Your Honor, and the defect is here in paragraph 21. It's alleged in two separate ways. One is it presented a risk the plaintiff's decedent was far greater than any social utility. The second is that it's unsafe.
No, wait a minute. That may be the result, but what's the defect?
The standard, as in Alaska pleading law, where you, in notice pleading states where you plead negligence, you're permitted to plead negligence as notice. Here, defect is pled as notice. Going into the specific type of defects would suggest that we're not going to argue each of the defects that are available. There are three types of defects available under our law.
Well, what do you say? The case Mr. Cole cited, which is an Alaska case, doesn't apply to your case?
I don't believe the case is going to hold precisely as it was argued to the court. We have cited a notice pleading case as well in our brief. We believe that notice pleading standards are going to be met by this type of pleading. The notice that is required is that we give a short and simple statement of the conduct that was alleged. We've alleged, as was done in the Bullock case, both in paragraph 16, 17, and 18, false and misleading concealments. Those concealments, when tied to the defects claimed in paragraph 21, will meet the same test that was identified in Bullock as a failure to meet reasonable consumer expectations by virtue of the subterfuge of changing those expectations with misleading the public. As to the risk greater than utility, it's specifically pled here in notice pleading standards. To have to go forward further than that, it's not necessarily under Alaska law.
All right. Case argued is submitted. Thank you both, counsel.
Thank you.
All right, the next case on calendar is Munn versus University of Alaska.